With that, let me go ahead and officially welcome everyone to today's CLUIN seminar. My name is Jean Balance, and I'm coming to you from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as one of your online moderators for today's broadcast. Our seminar will look at EPA's methodology for understanding and reducing a project's environmental footprint, and it's been sponsored by EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. In just a few moments, I'm going to turn things over to one of our co-presenters, Carlos Patron, to give you some more context of the session. But before we do that, I'd like to cover a couple of basic reminders and instructions on how our seminar will operate. When you signed up for today's event, you would have received an email message that contained instructions on how to join us for the live broadcast. That email would have referenced or pointed you to something called the seminar homepage, where you'd be able to read complete details about the event, you'd be able to download electronic copies of the materials that will be presented, you'll find contact information and bios for the presenters, and most importantly, you will find a button in the upper right corner, probably upper left corner, that says Go to Seminar. If you click that, that will actually ask you to identify yourself and allow you to check yourself in online. And when you do that, it'll bring you into our online interactive Adobe Connect environment. So I encourage everyone, if you haven't checked in online and joined us through Adobe, please do so now. The entire broadcast is going to be delivered through an online interactive tool named Adobe Connect, which will allow our participants to sit back and watch in real time as our presenters move through materials and deliver their talks. This is a more interactive tool, so if you've been a longtime CLUIN seminar attendee, you may notice that this is running very different than how our previous seminars have operated. We will be asking for your feedback on the new tool, so we appreciate any comments or suggestions you can make in how we deliver our seminars in the future. If you have technical problems and cannot join us through the live interactive Adobe room, that's okay. You can still download a copy of the materials and simply follow in along the phone. The only problem is there may be some portions of the session that you won't be able to participate in, so we encourage you to please try to join us online through Adobe if you can. By default, audio is available online for all attendees. You'll actually be able to listen to the entire broadcast through your computer or even mobile device. If you have problems with the volume, I'd first ask you to check your local volume settings on your speaker. You may simply need to increase the speaker output or use a pair of headphones. If that still doesn't work, we have toll-free call-in information. Simply type a message into the Q&A window, which I'll cover in just a moment, and request a call-in number, and I'll be happy to give you that toll-free number so you can join us on the phone lines. Just please know, if you join us on the telephone lines, you can just be aware that the telephone lines will be globally muted, and we would ask that everybody remain on that global mute to help cut down on background noises and other audio disruptions. We will provide information on how to take yourself off of mute to ask a question, but again, please remain muted until we get to that point. Questions and answers will be taken at designated points in today's broadcast. You can use the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen, to type up comments or questions or report technical problems at any time. And at that point, our moderators and presenters will actually take breaks for questions and will read your questions out loud so that our speakers can answer them. If you're on the phones, we'll remind you how to take yourself off of mute so you can ask them out loud. But there's no need to wait to type up your questions. You can do that at any point. We encourage you to type them up as soon as they occur to you. Another reminder, this entire session is being recorded and will be automatically archived. So it usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks, and once that archive is available, you will get an email directing you back on how you can replay the archive, and you're certainly welcome to forward that on to coworkers who will find it useful. If you like what we're doing here, we do have nearly 500 archived seminars that are available for free replay on the CLUIN website. Just one last reminder, again, you're going to be in an online interactive room that will allow you to watch the entire broadcast as our presenters move through their materials here. If you have any difficulties with what they're showing you, there's a full screen button that appears in the upper right corner. You can click that, and that'll blow up the size of their slides. To turn it off, simply press full screen again. You'll see the CLUIN logo in the upper right corner, a collection of related websites. You can press or click on them and then press the browser button to open them. And then that all-important Q&A window in the lower right corner. You can type up your comments or questions here, press enter or hit the little cartoon bubble, and that'll privately submit them in the background. I think that's the end of the reminders that I have for today's broadcast. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to my co-host, Carlos Pichon. Carlos?
Jean, thank you very much for handling the introductions and all the logistics. Much appreciated. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Carlos Pachon. I'm with the Superfund program here in headquarters, and I will be speaking through the first part of today's webinar on methods and tools for environmental footprint assessment. The other person that will be covering the topic is Hillary Thornton. Hillary is with our region, EPA Region 4 office. He is a remedial project manager and is also a member of the engineering forum. And he will be covering some material that was originally going to be covered by a colleague of ours from the Region 9 office, Karen Sherman. She's with the Corrective Action Program in Region 9, and she has been one of the lead folks developing the methodology and particularly the spreadsheets that we'll be talking about and that Hillary will be walking you through in more detail. Unfortunately, she had jury duty this week, so she wasn't able to join us, but Hillary is covering for her. The other person you see on the screen is Stephanie Vaughn, and she is the lead for the engineering forum green remediation team. So with that, I'll go ahead and get started. Let me take you to the first slide, which is slide 6. And this is the breakout of the webinar of the workshop. First, I'll be covering some background on green remediation policy and core elements. I'll do that rather quickly. I'm sorry for those of you who are hearing this material for the first time. It is for your benefit, but we've had previous webinars on this topic, and I suspect that a majority of the audience is quite familiar with these, but I thought it important that we put it out there in case there's members of the audience who are not familiar with what our policy backgrounds are on the topic of green cleanups. I will then briefly describe the footprint evaluation methodology, what it consists of, how it operates. I will do a basic run-through of what happens when one is conducting a footprint analysis, and then hand it over to Hillary Thornton, who will walk you through more details of how data actually flows through the CEPA spreadsheets. After that, we have some questions discussion questions, and we'll also be taking questions from you in the audience. I will be monitoring the questions that are submitted, but since I will be speaking, I may rely on Jean and possibly Hillary to help me identify which ones need an immediate answer. At the end of that, we've provided some links to important documents such as the methodology, as well as the CEPA worksheet, the worksheets, where to download them, etc. And there's also, of course, as usual, feedback form, and your feedback would be greatly appreciated. With that, we'll go to sorry, I'm getting used to these slides. There's some transition. So let me move on to some policy background. I'll start with that definition of green remediation, at least as we use it across cleanup programs in Superfund. We define it as the practice of considering all the environmental effects of remedy implementation and incorporating options to minimize the environmental footprints of cleanup actions. There are other terms that are being used, such as greening response actions. That's a term preferred by the removal program. There are greener cleanups, which is a broader one, often used in cross-program documents. But basically, they're all looking at the same thing. How can we ensure that we meet our mission of protecting human health and the environment from contaminated media? And how can we achieve that protectiveness with a lower environmental footprint? Okay, go to the next slide. So there are policy drivers at many levels, everything from executive orders. There was one from the Obama administration, 13514, on federal leadership, environment, and energy, and economic performance, basically stating that it's the policy of the United States that federal agencies, in a fulfillment of their mission, do so with a lower environmental footprint. That's, I guess, the summary. You can read the text that's been copied there from the Obama administration administrative executive order. And then there's a previous one, 13423, from the Bush administration, So regardless of your political affiliation, there is an executive order for you. That carries on to the EPA strategic plan for the 2011-2015, our goal 3 on cleaning up communities and advancing sustainable development states that we will be implementing green remediation, the green remediation strategy in the Superfund program. In OSWER, which is the office under which all cleanup programs are grouped, the principles for green cleanups from 2009 stated that as a matter of policy, it is our goal to evaluate cleanup actions to ensure protection of human health and environment while reducing the environmental footprint of those activities. And then more specific to my program within Superfund, we have a green remediation strategy, which is already well into its third year, and actually the majority of the actions identified there have already been implemented. We often get a question on sustainability and cleanup programs, and it seemed at first that we were talking past each other, different groups asking, well, do you not consider social and economic considerations? It seems like green remediation is only about environmental. And we added these slides to clarify that point a little bit about how and where we consider, quote-unquote, the triple bottom line in our remediation programs, including social aspects such as engaging community in site cleanup decisions and turning contaminated sites into community assets, or on the economic front, how we pursue redevelopment in blighted areas, we foster employment opportunities in communities where sites are cleaned up. The remediation work itself is an economic engine. And, of course, we do all this with an environmental goal of protecting human health and the environment, and an added benefit that liberating contaminated sites for reuse frees up green space. However, we identify that we still have a challenge on the environmental front, and that is, or an opportunity, if you like, that we can achieve this protectiveness with a lower environmental footprint. But a little bit more detail on two slides on those social and economic aspects. The first one is community involvement, which is what we consider to be, certainly in the Superfund program that's common across other programs, a robust, quote-unquote, social leg. By law, Superfund requires community input in remedy decisions and implementation. It's not something we think we do it because we think it's good. It is good, but it's also required by law. To do that, EPA parallels the International Association for Public Participation 7 core values of public participation. There are some pretty important ones in there, such as, actively engaging the community to understand what their concerns are, informing them of how their concerns were taken into consideration, what decisions were made, and all along providing information so that they can participate in a meaningful way. EPA has had a community involvement policy since 1981, and there are nearly 100 community involvement coordinators across the 10 regional offices. EPA also provides technical assistance in the form of grants and services to ensure that communities are independently advised on these often challenging technical issues. And our experience shows that good community involvement results in even better remedies, both because of community buy-in to that decision, but also because of many technical aspects, because often the residents or the citizens in the immediate vicinity of the site have experience on the history of the site that helps develop a better conceptual site model of where contamination is, where it might have come from, where it might have gone. On the economic front, another angle that we think we have a pretty robust practice right now, but the main point is, as with community involvement, is that in Superfund, remedial action objectives factor reasonably anticipated future land use. So that is an important factor in determining how we're going to clean up a contaminated site. EPA also serves as an active partner in helping return sites to productive uses, such as funding reuse assessments and redevelopment planning, removing reuse barriers, whether real or perceived, and partnering with local governments, communities, developers, and others. Equally important is the fact that sites ready for anticipated reuse is a key Superfund GPRA goal. That is an agency goal for which the administrator is accountable. So the fact that we get sites ready for reuse is in fact one of our measures of performance as an agency. And then looking at data on sites that have been redeveloped in the Superfund program, because that is where we have where I work and we have more information on. There are currently annually 300 businesses at 142 Superfund sites with redevelopment, where redevelopment has taken place, generate $8.8 billion in sales, 25,000 jobs, and $1.6 billion in employment income. The point is, social leg, economic leg, we feel we're doing pretty good. There is an opportunity to improve the performance of the remedies as far as lowering the environmental footprint. How can we do that? The first area is that we first look at what those remedies are. So any footprint reduction is always going to be consistent with science and engineering principles. Before we look at a footprint, we first want to make sure that we have an accurate conceptual site model. This is an area that's one of developing rather quickly, especially when it comes to well-characterized source areas and contaminant plumes. Concepts such as high-resolution site characterization that allow us to better target remedies to source areas and combine those with other remedies. That's the concept between appropriate remedy selection or remedy strategy more than selection. Appropriate remedy strategy where we might have a more aggressive remedy for the source area. We might have something else for the plume, and then possibly M&A for the distal areas of the plume. Another important aspect is sound engineering, how these remedies are designed, and streamlined performance monitoring. Let's not turn these on and let them run. Let's turn them on, monitor, and adjust, the concept of adaptive management. Adjust these remedies as they evolve, as they progress. Once we have all those factors in place, we look at focusing and greening the resulting remedy. So what does an environmental footprint look like? What is it that we're talking about? Way back in 2008, when we first put out a primer on green remediation, we had broken out an environmental footprint into these five core elements: energy, air, water, materials and waste, and land ecosystems. An important aspect of this, and one of the things we're looking at, is how can we reduce the environmental footprint of a remedy, looking at all the elements that may apply at a particular site. With respect to energy, we're looking at energy efficiency and renewables. With air, protecting air quality and greenhouse gases are both factored in there. With water, it's water decreasing water use, maximizing potential for reuse, and improving water quality or protecting water quality in the vicinity of sites. With materials in use, it's the classic minimize, reuse, and recycle. And then with land and ecosystems, the basic concept is to protect ecosystem services available at the site. With energy and air emissions, we're looking at reducing emissions of criteria pollutants, be it particulate matter, SOx, NOx, or greenhouse gases, and looking at energy efficiency practices and renewable energy at the site. So let's first reduce consumption. If we have a balance of energy use, when we have a balance of energy use, look at renewables. And if there's still a balance of energy that's not renewable, then we may consider options such as renewable energy credits versus launching right into renewable energy credits. That falls back to that previous slide we saw on first design an efficient system and then apply footprint reduction measures. Water use and conservation, this is a very important one. Often we hear in several discussions, several venues, when there's talk about environmental footprint, a focus on greenhouse gases. One of the things I want to emphasize and we want to get across is the importance of the other parameters, such as water and clean air. When it comes to water use and conservation, it's a matter of reducing potable water reuse. identifying options for reusing water from treatment systems, and C, reducing impacts of on-surface water quality in the vicinity of sites. An example is that picture we have there of a portable closed-loop wheel washing system for reducing on-site and off-site track out during construction. A, that's, you know, definitely a good practice and often a required practice. But B, that system itself, there's a footprint reduction measure in that the water that is being used isn't a closed circuit system, so we get to reuse that water, and there's less water that has to be put a potable water consumed, and less water has to be treated off-site. So that's just an example of what we are talking about here. With materials and waste, we want to reduce hazardous waste generated on-site, use recycled materials to the extent possible in building and operating a treatment system, and recycling materials generated on-site, the basic concepts such as construction and demolition debris, which is often lots of these are often common practices in other sectors. What we're looking at doing is incorporating them to the extent practicable in our contaminated site cleanups. The last one we have here is our land and ecosystems. This one is still, as far as the methodology is concerned, as we'll talk about a little bit later, we're basically looking at protecting ecosystem services on site. There's a lot of work taking place in the agency with respect to the definition of ecosystem services, and we're pending how that evolves. There is also a scale challenge in that lots of these services are at an ecosystem level, and the impact we may have at a local site makes it difficult to define best practices. But still, there are concepts such as soil erosion control, nutrient uptake and water quality protection, and wildlife habitat, especially possibly for a critical endangered species. Okay, so that was that basic policy background, some basic concepts associated with green remediation, what it is that we're trying to achieve. How do we go about implementing green remediation? We see that there are basically two approaches to doing that. The first is a direct use of best management practices. There are a series of common remedial approaches, the most in across all programs, and the most common of which is definitely a quote-unquote dig and haul or excavation and surface restoration, and other common remedies for groundwater and for soil like pump and treat, bioremediation, soil vapor extraction, et cetera. What we have done is produced a series of fact sheets specific to either the most common types of cleanups or the most common types of sites, and some of that are media specific, like clean fuel and emission technologies for site cleanup. The idea here is that, for example, somebody's doing the tank yank. Well, there are literally thousands of those taking place at any given year. We have a fact sheet specific to sites with leaking underground storage tank systems. What actions typically take place at a tank yank, and what can we do to minimize the environmental footprint? So one may decide to go straight into download one of those fact sheets and apply all the BMPs that are most applicable to their remedy. Or for larger, more complex sites, it may be necessary to apply the footprint methodology because we don't know exactly what that system looks like. So the main message here is we don't expect that the footprint methodology will be applied at every cleanup. In fact, quite often, those fact sheets may be sufficient to get us a lot of footprint reduction. However, for complex sites, we are looking at and we are applying the footprint methodology. And that's what we're going to talk about next. So given this is going into Module 2, and that is about the footprint itself. So the goal of a footprint evaluation is to identify the most significant contributors to a project's environmental footprint and better focus efforts to reduce it. This is the first bullet, and it's an important one because often it's a very basic concept. The idea of running a performing footprint evaluation is to identify the largest footprint contributors and better target our efforts to reduce it. So we don't go chasing ounces of SOx or NOx, but we focus our efforts on the largest contributors to the footprint. Footprint evaluations are not required for a cleanup, but if conducted, this is our preferred methodology, and this is why what we are training our project managers on, and what working with our consulting engineering firms on applying at the projects when we deem it necessary. Remedy selection process remains unchanged in all cleanup programs. This is very important, including the Superfund program. This does not affect the remedy selection process. We see footprint evaluations being conducted, possibly at design construction phase, and being applied in that process. We're not saying they cannot be and should not be conducted prior to remedy selection. In fact, they may provide some information that can be used in the remedy selection process in the different programs, such as short-term effectiveness in the case of Superfund. But rarely do we see the information from the footprint being a driving factor or tipping the balance for one remedy or another. It's more a matter of once we have identified what remedy reaches the goals that we're seeking, how can we build and operate that remedy with a low environmental footprint. So the methodology is built around the five core elements we talked about earlier, and it provides some common footprint metrics and process to quantify them. So the idea is that across programs and across regions here in EPA, we would be talking about the same thing and have a uniform protocol for achieving those quantifications. It's designed to be generally compatible with existing footprinting tools. There are, for example, the services, the Army and the Air Force and the Corps of Engineers have worked with other parties to develop footprinting tools, and there are others out there, a lot of in-house ones that consulting engineering firms have. There are certain differences either in the process for quantifying, the scope. Some are full life cycle tools. This one is not. And also in some of the metrics. We continue to work with other parties to identify those differences and understand where they arise and how we can tackle them. But generally, it's the footprint methodology is really quite consistent with many of those. It's based on the lessons learned from multiple projects where we, over the last 4 years, where we have conducted footprint analyses. And it includes practical assistance internally, such as conversion factors for commonly used materials. Those are hard to come by, and once they've been identified, once we identify them, we've compiled them into the methodology. It's got a suggested process for screening out spawn contributors and on establishing grid electricity footprints. So again, before we get into the methodology itself, a little bit more background. Based on our pilot projects, this is a question we often get. The cost of a footprint analysis seems to be ranging from $5,000 to $15,000 US dollars, which is not an insignificant number, especially for small sites. However, the value of the information used in a multi-million dollar project, it well merits the cost of running the footprint analysis. Another point is that we're finding that running the footprint analyses often exposes inefficiencies in treatment systems that would not be identified through pure engineering or cost analyses, and allow us to ask questions of how we might better operate our system that result in cost savings greater than the cost of performing the analysis itself. The footprint analysis cost can be lower when performed with other site activities, especially at the design or maybe through an optimization. That's where, in the Superfund program, we are building a lot of these footprint evaluations. It's into remedy optimization analyses or early on in the design construction with a lot of the data that's required for footprint evaluation is already available. This methodology is not unique to any one program. It's really about building and operating treatment systems, and it applies to investigation, design, construction, operation phases regardless of the remedy type, site type, or program under which the cleanup takes place. Okay. So what does the methodology look like? The main text, the document itself, which can be downloaded as a PDF, and I believe there are also hard copies for those that really like them. They can be ordered from Kluin.org. It's got a basic introduction, discussion of the metrics, and the walks through the footprint methodology, some considerations for interpreting the footprint, and we'll talk about those today, and some basic approaches to reducing the footprint. But from there on, it basically points users to the best management practices that are available out there. The appendices are the mechanics of a footprint analysis. That's where the bulk of the document is located. It's got the exhibits, the data presentation formats, and three footprint reduction scenarios to help people understand how to apply the methodology. It's got three on materials and waste, three on energy, on water, and three on energy and air. This exhibit 17 in Appendix B provides provide practical assistance and help managing the flow information. We'll talk about that in a second. It is relatively data rich, but once that data is compiled and inserted into the worksheets, the footprint summary starts to build itself. And we'll talk, that's mostly the purpose of today's webinar. We're going to talk about that in a little bit more detail. So in order to help that happen, this is definitely new. Some of you may have been on the webinar about a year ago. At that time, we did not provide or had not released the spreadsheets for environmental footprint analysis. Those are now available. They've been available for a while. We can see they're being downloaded. We are receiving questions and some comments on perfecting them. So we know they seem to be working quite well for people out there. They are available online with the methodology. We're not in the business of developing software, but we had to develop these for in-house use, and we got clear messages that there would be a value because people were attempting to recreate them, to apply the methodology. So we made them available. Of course, they are built based on the methodology. The use is optional. There's an example tutorial provided online at this point. They are Microsoft Excel-based, so Excel skills are required to be able to use them. And we'll be talking about, that's the part that Hillary will be talking about in some more detail. So let me go into the metrics that are included in the methodology. With respect to energy, there are two main metrics. The first is total energy use, and the other is total energy voluntarily derived from renewable resources. Again, always remember that the goal of the methodology and the metrics it provides are to provide a project manager with information that helps him or her identify where that footprint can be reduced. So obviously the first point is how can we reduce our energy use. The second one is how can we expand the use of renewable energy resources. And the voluntarily is important because there are certain regions in the country where the grid is already has a rich mix of renewable energy resources. The idea is how can we augment that? There's always an opportunity to maybe use local or project-specific renewable energy. That's the idea behind that terminology of voluntarily derived renewable resources versus grid-derived renewable energy sources. With respect to air, of course, greenhouse gases are then. That's what a lot of people tend to gravitate toward when they think of environmental footprint. Don't believe it's the most important one, but it certainly is one of the well-recognized ones. So how can we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions? How can we reduce criteria pollutants, SOx, NOx, or particulate matter, either from on-site emissions or total emissions? And how can we reduce hazardous air pollutants, again, either on-site or total HAP emissions? So with respect to water, as we mentioned earlier, we seek to reduce the amount of quality, the quantity of water we use. Maybe look at alternative sources of water. So do we really need drinking water, potable water, or can we use process system water for on-site? And then what is the fate of used and treated water? Are we discharging to a PLDW, or are there other options to reuse that water? either on-site or off-site. With materials and waste, this is one of the bigger elements as far as data requirements are concerned, as we'll see in a minute. What we are seeking here is to determine refined materials used on our site. So what is the quantity and percent from recycled materials, which is a number we would try to increase, would strive to increase. For bulk unrefined materials used on a site, what is the quantity and the percent from recycled materials? So again, can we use less whole total? And of the total used, can a greater portion of it be from recycled materials? And then finally, waste. We want to quantify the hazardous waste generated on site, non-hazardous waste generated on site, and percent of total potential waste generated on site that is recycled or reused. And finally, land and ecosystems. As I said earlier, this is a qualitative evaluation. Identify what those ecosystem services available on site may be and how we can take action to reduce negatively impact those services. So how will EPA use the footprint methodology? As I mentioned earlier, through the engineering forum, colleagues Hillary and Stephanie and others, we are training technical staff on understanding and reducing the footprint. So how is the footprint run and what actions can we take based on the information it generates? We are conducting footprint analyses at our own sites when and where appropriate. Certainly that's the case in the Superfund program. And we expect to use a methodology to facilitate the evaluation of environmental footprint studies performed, submitted to EPA by outside parties. So that'll be, in a sense, the lens through which we'll be looking at them at footprint evaluations. We would recommend to PRPs to follow the methodology if they plan on conducting footprint evaluations, or at least understand it to see where how we will be interpreting footprint evaluations. The online training is under development. That includes this course here, as well as a more expanded course, which Hillary will refer to, on the footprint analyses. We've already conducted a series of in-house webinars, more detail on the application of the spreadsheets. Today you'll get a flavor of what they're like, and in the subsequent webinar, we will be going through those in more detail. And then, of course, as the purpose is to document footprint reductions at our own cleanup sites. We also see the methodology being of value for that purpose. Okay, we'll now go into Module 3. On performing environmental footprint analysis. And again, this will be a rather quick walkthrough. It's not that dissimilar from the one we did last year. I want to get to section 4, which is the part that will hand off to Hillary on the application. I'm sorry, I'm going through my notes here just a second. So the methodology, the footprint evaluation methodology, has 7 basic steps. One is to set the, and we'll walk through these. I'm going to walk you through these in the next 10 or 15 minutes. The first one is setting up the goals and the scope of the analysis. At that point, we would gather the remedy information that's going to be required to enter into the spreadsheets, which is what we're currently using to process it. We start with quantifying on-site materials and waste metrics. Again, that's based on our experience that a lot of the information on waste, on materials and waste, will automatically filter down to the other core elements. We then quantify on-site water metrics. We quantify energy and air metrics. We qualitatively describe affected ecosystem services, and then we look at the results and analyze these. So the first part is setting goals and scope of the analysis. So the first is, what do we hope to accomplish by conducting the footprint analysis at a specific project? For example, the goal may be to identify remedy activities that are key contributors to the footprint and recommend footprint reductions. That's generally going to be what we are seeking to achieve, but there may be other specific parameters. You got to think, you know, for example, we want to better understand what our water footprint is because we are in a drier region. There may be different drivers for conducting the footprint analyses. A second important part is the scope. What aspects of the remedy are to be included in the analyses, depending on where we are in the life of the remedy, particularly if it's in operation maintenance. We may be focusing on performance monitoring, but not system construction. In another example, the scope may include a groundwater remedy, but not the sole remedy component of it. So there may be reasons to do subcomponents of a remedy rather than a whole system. Another point is to define the boundaries of the analysis in the functional unit, and we'll talk about that in our example in a minute, and the footprint methodology does provide some examples of how that can be done. Okay, we'll now move on to slide 34, and I'm looking at screening of the inputs. The methodology provides some protocols and some suggestions of how that can be undertaken. Basically, the idea here is that we want to have a point at which we decide whether to pursue a component of the footprint or not. It can be an absolute number, or it can be a percent of contributor to that core element. We would apply the screening units, the limits, or define the screening limits for the refined materials, unrefined materials, non-hazardous waste, the on-site water, the NOx, SOx, in particulate matter, on-site HAPS, in total energy use. And again, exclude the items or define that limit for the footprint contributors smaller or below the screening limit. Okay, so we move on to that first key part of the CIFA spreadsheets, which, again, Hillary will be going through in some more detail, and that is quantifying the materials and waste metrics, after which we will quantify on-site water metrics, and then quantify the energy and air metrics. Might look like. As you can see, the light blue on the left-hand side, this is data provided by the user, and it's, you know, part of the methodology and of the spreadsheets. It will ask you what are the materials in use. You do need to have some information on the system, on the treatment system, on what its operating parameters are. One of the advantages of using the spreadsheets now is that we can build incrementally. As more information becomes available, we can expand on it and get a higher, quote-unquote, resolution or better, reduced uncertainty associated with that final footprint. But here it provides an example of how the data would be entered, is entered into the spreadsheet, the series of units from material in use, and the quantity of each one of these. In the middle columns, we have some information that is provided by the CIFA spreadsheets themselves, mostly those conversion factors, which is a lot of the value added of using the spreadsheets. You can check and see what those conversion factors are, and if you have different units, you can adjust them. But they are, you know, there's a source for those numbers, so you don't have to go about finding out how many pounds of building steel there are in a cubic foot. Then you have the percent recycled or reused. And that converts it all into recycled and virgin pounds, which is the standard unit for materials in use. You've got the readout a bit further down. On refined materials total, for example, 7,670. And remember, the idea here is to look for opportunities to increase that. In this case, we see that less than 1% of the materials on this project are from recycled or reused content, which is a low number. But if we look at the total of the 50 million, we can see that a lot of that that there may be opportunity for increasing those, and that's what we're going to talk about in just a minute. Okay, we move on to waste metrics. In this case, no waste. There's 3,000 pounds of recycled or reused waste on site. In landfill waste, we have 7,800 tons of dewatered precipitated metal sludge. One important question here is that, as we said earlier, what we're trying to do is achieve a lower environmental footprint. In this case, we have hazardous waste disposed. Question for yourselves, and we'll discuss this a little bit later, is why would we want to reduce the amount of hazardous waste disposed when the purpose of the remedy itself is to extract hazardous waste? So it seems like there's a bit of a contradiction there, but think about that and we'll discuss it in the Q&A session. Okay, then we've got the on-site water metrics. As we said earlier, we want to know the amount of potable public water supply, extracted groundwater, surface water, and reclaimed water, collective diverted stormwater, or other water source. That will provide us with a water footprint, and then we move on to quantifying energy and air metrics. From the electrical equipment, we'll get the electricity usage from natural gas, of course, natural gas, transportation equipment, or provide us the fuel usage. And as I said earlier, some of these data points you may not have a good feel for early on, especially in the design phase, but the spreadsheets allow you to update these as they become available and better define what your footprint is and decide whether you need to take action in a certain footprint element or not. So those energy terms are then, the spreadsheet takes, for example, for CO2, it takes the corresponding conversion factors, which are already built in. So for example, for electricity, fuel combustion, materials, et cetera, as you enter the project data into the CIFA spreadsheets, they apply the conversion factor and roll it up into your remedies carbon footprint, CO2 equivalent footprint. The same process takes place automatically for the SOx, NOx, particulate matter, and hazardous air pollutant footprint. So as you enter the data, it builds these for you. We mentioned earlier that for now it's basically a qualitative description of affected ecosystem services. And we will continue to look at these as we go forward. And there are some suggestions of what ecosystem services are typically available at a site and what we can do is to reduce impacts on them. But we do not currently have them as a quantified component of the footprint analysis. So as we have entered this data, the footprint, the CIFA spreadsheets have rolled them all up into the environmental footprint summary, which is one of the three spreadsheets that are part of the CIFA package. I think Hillary will discuss in a little bit more detail how they function. Basically, they generally have to be in the same directory, but they do interact on their own, so there's no need to transfer data back and forth between them. But it rolls it up. So here's an example of this project. And we've got the 14 parameters laid out here. Again, the idea is to look at this footprint from the get-go and through the spreadsheets and the methodology have that breakdown of what the system looks like so we can identify where there may be inefficiencies or where we can take action to reduce that footprint. A few key concepts here, which I hope to get through my slides quickly so we can have some of this discussion, but some of the questions, once we've done the quantification, are what do we do with this information? That's really... Sorry, I just lost my connection. I'll keep on talking while it comes back. The idea is once we have performed the quantification, what do we do with that information? So how accurate, some of the questions we're going to ask ourselves, let's go straight to these because we have a slide for each. How accurate are the results? So certainly think about the uncertainties in some of the key parameters. How long will the system be operating? What is the amount of soil removal necessary? Other uncertainties associated with some of the major contributors. For greenhouse gas, it could be electricity use, chemical use, natural gas for building heat, et cetera. And be aware of the estimates in the calculations. Look at the conversion factors if necessary. Look closely at your fuel usage estimates and transportation distances. Anyway, there are quite a few variables and uncertainties associated with the variables, but the spreadsheets, the structure of the spreadsheets allows you to do a sensitivity analysis of what is really driving some of those footprint contributors. But keep in mind that the results are never going to be exact. It's usually going to be a matter of a relative quantification. Just a quick check, Gene, if you're on, my screen is doing some funny things. I need to know that everything is coming across okay on Adobe Connect.
Yes, everything is coming perfectly clear on our end.
Okay, thank you. So another discussion, we've talked about the uncertainty or, associated with the metrics that have been derived. Another is what parameters are of greatest importance. And, of course, that's very project specific. For example, particulate emissions may be important for a region that is a non-attainment, as far as air quality is concerned. But greenhouse gas emissions may be more important to a municipality with greenhouse gas reduction goals. In the case of water, the water footprint may be more important in arid lands where there are restrictions in water supply versus other regions of the country where there is an abundance of potable water. And waste generation may be important for community with concerns regarding landfill space. So anyway, there may be different drivers once you have quantified the footprint of remedy. There may be additional external drivers on what footprint elements one should take action on. The other question, can we use the results to target areas for improvement? Definitely. That we are finding we can. As I said earlier, sometimes footprint evaluations reveals maybe inefficiencies or certain components of remedy that we would not have looked at closely if we were performing a peer engineering or cost analysis, as in this case here, looking at footprint contributors from remedy, and we'll look at that in a little bit more detail. What controls the big contributors? This is a hypothetical site where we're looking at you have electricity, production of materials, and transport of waste. We've got the different actions that contribute to that. And in more detail, what it is that we're achieving with those actions. And that is what allows us, that breakdown of the remedy, sorry about that, is what allows us to identify where we can take action to reduce the operating parameters that most contribute to that footprint element. Okay, I'm very quickly going to go through this. Yes, it's case study because I do want to hand it off to Hillary. I'm already up to almost an hour. This is a project that one of the first projects where we have conducted a footprint evaluation. And again, this is a project that was managed by a footprint that was conducted by Karen Scher. There's an interim pump and treat system operating for many years. And what we saw here is that the pump and treat system initially removed volatile organic carbons through air stripping. But over time, granular-activated carbon was added to the system due to exceedances of discharge criteria. It seemed like these exceedances continued, and discharge to the surface water was changed to discharge to the sanitary sewer. So using these various processes resulted in very high energy and greenhouse gas and air quality footprints. So when Karen conducted the green remediation evaluation, the influent concentrations and treatment processes were reviewed, and it found that increasing the air to water ratio allowed the greenhouse granular activated carbon to be discontinued, and with a further enhancement of the air stripping, allowed the discharge to be switched back from sanitary sewer to surface water. So what did this look like? This is focusing in this case on greenhouse gas. What we see is the original footprint on the left-hand side here. Let me use a little arrow. So this is the original footprint. After improving the air stripping, we found that we were able to remove the granular activated carbon, and we had an important reduction in the carbon footprint from that part. Further eliminating the POTW resulted in a further reduction from not having to treat that water, and then looking at renewable energy potential at the site allowed us a further footprint reduction. Another example, and this one, again, we'll be doing very quickly just to get a feel. The idea here is that the application of the footprint methodology at an underground storage tank removal can also result in data that can be used in determining where we want to focus that footprint reduction. True that often the units, the quantities of the units are much smaller than what we would have on a large project such as the one that we just saw earlier, but doing it across multiple sites, we will see a significant reduction in that footprint component, in the footprint of those different remedies. So I wish to hand it off to Hillary because he has some material to cover. So instead of covering these case studies in detail and the discussion of it, I'm going to pass it on to him. But again, as we were saying here, conducting this footprint evaluation at an underground storage tank help us identify what the footprint footprint contributors were, what action we could take, and we're able to do a summary of the footprint reductions we had achieved. So with that, let me check, Hillary or Jean, what do you recommend with respect to questions? I'm looking at the screen and I'm not reading them very well.
Carlos, this is Jean. We did have one or two questions that came in from the attendees. I just want to remind everybody, you can continue to type up your questions and comments at any point using the Q&A window. One of the questions came in asking in reference to one of the tables that you had displayed, but you were able to answer it later on. A participant wanted to be sure that the table included both recycled and reused materials that were bought, and then recycling and reuse on the site, which was in reference to the table on slide 36, but you were able to address that question. So if anybody on the phone lines has a question, you're certainly welcome to hit #6 and unmute your phone line, and feel free to identify yourself or organization and then ask your question out loud. Okay. Well, in the interest of time, I see we segue right on into Hillary's content, and we can continue to take in questions and comments from the audience and take another break later on in today's broadcast.
Thank you, Jean. Hillary, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm ready to proceed with the next module on the spreadsheets for environmental footprint analysis. So let's go ahead with that. So CIFA is a set of Excel workbooks that was developed by EPA. Carlos introduced it a little bit earlier. They're designed for conducting environmental footprint analysis at cleanup sites. They're compatible with EPA's footprinting methodology. They're set up in a blank slate template format, structured for inputting data, running calculations, and organizing inputs. They are originally designed for internal EPA use, but they have been placed on the EPA webpage for public access. We realized that they were so good that they needed to be shared, and we're very happy that we're able to do that. So there's a URL at the bottom of this slide 56 that shows where they are, and you'll also get another opportunity to be pointed to a location where you can download them later on in the presentation at the on the resources slide towards the end. So in the context of EPA's footprint methodology, CIFA focuses on steps 3, 4, and 5 right there in the middle, help you to quantify various items that need to be quantified. They are a spreadsheet tool. They do the calculations for you. You enter the assumptions and the background information, and they'll go through, run the calculations, include a pre-built library of conversion factors so that you don't have to look those up, and produce a table of results, and they'll even help you to interpret those results. So CIFA is structured in the form of 3 Excel workbooks. There's a main workbook where the user enters basic site information and data for the materials, waste and water. There's an energy workbook where the user sets up the analytic structure and enters data for on-site and off-site activities. And then a calculations workbook where there's no data entry done by the user, but that's where the workbook makes its footprint calculations. And if you really want to look under the hood and see how the calculations are being done, you could certainly look at that calculations workbook and see how these spreadsheets are doing their work for you. So the user sets up the analytic structure, enters information about the remedy, and then the workbooks exchange data and process those results. So now let's look at some data entry sheets for material, waste, and water. Here's a material one. The example is a backfill, an unrefined material. You can see there in the yellow, user has entered some data about clean fill from offsite for backfilling, et cetera, the units, the quantity, the conversion factor, and then the system takes it from there. For waste, there's some soil to going to the landfill. It's a waste footprint. And then there's another one for water, the water footprint of your excavation. Data entry sheets for energy and activities. They have a personnel transportation section. They have an on-site equipment section, electricity usage, and a spot where you can put in miscellaneous information. And you can see along the bottom of the tabs, there are several tabs across the bottom there as well. Tabs across the bottom. The next sheet is data entry sheets for energy and activities continued. That has your materials production and transport, your waste management and transport, and your miscellaneous actions, as well as your lab analysis. You'll note on this next slide that we explain here the color coding for the cells, how that assists you with data entry. The red coded cells are the drop-down menu cells. When you click on one of those red cells, a drop-down menu will appear and you can choose one of the preloaded choices. The cells highlighted in blue have a lookup table data or calculated data in them, values from those sources, and the yellow is data entry by the user. Moving ahead to the worksheets where we apply footprint conversion factors. You have material, energy, and offsite support activities on there. Energy, greenhouse gases, NOx, SOx, PM, and HAPS, all displayed on that worksheet. The calculations workbook automatically applies the footprint conversion factors to all materials, energy, and offsite support activities, does the heavy lifting for you. And then the metrics are presented as suggested in the methodology. You have the materials, the waste, water, energy, and air. You'll remember those from earlier on when Carlos was presenting. Those are the same categories as suggested in the methodology, so it lines up. There are a few additional features in CIFA that I want to point out. CIFA can track renewable energy sources, enables the specifying of a local power mix for grid electricity. Throughout the country and around the world, the electricity coming into your project off of the grid is not always from the same source. For instance, up in the Pacific Northwest, there is a large percentage of hydropower grid on the mix, whereas in the South Central and Southeast regions, we have a lot of coal-fired power plants. So you might want to consider that and specify that to aid in making your footprint more accurate. You can establish unique footprint conversion factors. You may be doing something at your site that isn't built into the CIFA system, but it's flexible enough to allow you to establish your own. And lastly, you can model carbon storage in there. These and other features of CIFA allow flexibility for accurately modeling the specific site and remedy conditions. We recognize that each site, each remedy is different, and CIFA is able to handle that. So a quick overview of CIFA. It's flexible, designed for any site, any remedy, any level of detail, and any set of comparisons. But it does require experience to run. It should be run by experienced staff. It has a fairly steep learning curve because there is not an extensive user manual, and it does not have a really fancy user interface that hides these spreadsheets away from you. Instead, you're actually entering the data, write it directly into the spreadsheets yourselves. But it is pretty easy to run once you know how. And it's a hands-on system. You set up the structure and analysis to reflect your site. You enter the data directly into these Excel spreadsheets. And as I mentioned, it does not have a really glossy user interface. You're working directly with the spreadsheets. CIFA will automatically apply the footprint conversion factors for you. It automatically compiles the results, and it reflects the metrics and approach suggested in EPA's footprint methodology. EPA staff have started to use CIFA at our cleanup sites, and we encourage the use of CIFA by site owners and PRPs. There's a demonstration tutorial available online at the URL shown here on slide 66. That completes our CIFA summary, and now we're going to go into the lessons learned and discussion questions module. I'll start with the lessons learned. We have a few technical lessons learned. Feel free to chime in, Carlos, if you have anything to add. I know we're co-presenting this module, but we want to apply the science and engineering principles. The idea of footprint methodology is to enhance and improve, optimize the remedy that we selected, not for this to be a 10th criterion. It is not. So environmental footprint evaluations and BMPs complement optimization and should accompany typical remedial activities. Energy use and off-site support activities are significant contributors to many footprints. We'll need to remember that. Remedy footprints are site-dependent. They depend on the remedy type, the location, the contaminant type, and the geologic setting and hydrologic conditions. Analyses typically identify a few large contributors for each remedy type, and there can be some surprises in there. Looking at, these are just sort of some generic examples for in situ bioremediation and in situ chemical oxidation. A lot of times we see that nutrient production and transportation and performance monitoring are major contributors. And somewhat surprisingly, drilling and injection can be smaller than you might assume. With an excavation remedy, waste transportation and waste disposal are typically major contributors. And the system construction can be smaller than expected on an excavation-centered remedy. For pump and treat, vapor intrusion mitigation, and soil vapor extraction remedies, we see electricity and treatment chemicals, for example, GAC, being large contributors, and that the actual construction of your pump and treat or your other system is typically quite a small footprint relative to the electricity and the ongoing chemicals that are used in the operation of your system over time. Most of the green remediation. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, just on that, the link between these two last slides, I did want to point out that previous slide you just went through, that Hillary just went through, it identifies remedies such as bioremediation, pump and treat, soil vapor extraction, and excavation, all of which have a specific fact sheet, a green remediation fact sheet specific to those remedies, and they identify a lot of the best management practices that can be applied to reduce the footprint associated with those remedies. However, there are situations in which a larger, more complex project may reveal within all those BMPs where one would want to focus those footprint reduction efforts. So the fact that those fact sheets are available shouldn't preclude conducting a footprint analysis if we have a large and complex project. And Just to wrap up that slide that we're currently on, number 70, we mentioned earlier that the information gathering part is definitely the most labor-intensive part of a footprint analysis. Now that the methodology has been built and the CEPA spreadsheets are available, a lot of building the logic, you know, in the process to manage all that information and gathering conversion factors, et cetera, has been completed. But gathering the remedy information is probably going to be the most labor-intensive part of the footprint analysis. And another point is that the idea behind conducting footprint analysis is that there are a lot of short-term aggressive remedies out there, a lot of the ones for which we have done the footprint, fact sheets. A footprint analysis will often identify opportunities to reduce the environmental footprint of conducting these short-term aggressive remedies. So the fact that they have a large environmental footprint is possibly, you know, where that opportunity lies to achieve that footprint reduction, the fact that they already have a large one to start with. Then, of course, we're still going to be selecting those remedies because they do achieve a degree of protectiveness that other remedies can't get us. And we are seeing, for example, a rise in in-situ remedies that tend to be more aggressive because we're getting better at designing, building, and operating them and using them in conjunction with other remedies through remedial strategies. So from that point of view, we do expect that we will be performing more of these footprint evaluations so we can, these systems not only operate efficiently but operate with a lower environmental footprint. These short-term aggressive remedial approaches. Sorry, I wanted to mention those few points, Hillary.
No problem. It's time to get into our discussion questions now, as promised, and we've got a few here that Carlos and I have set out as some examples, and then we'll get to the phones and get questions from our audience. I'd like to throw this first one out to Carlos. If, for example, my pump and treat system is generating 7,800 tons of hazardous waste per year, why is it considered part of the footprint?
Right, and I put this one out there earlier. I'm checking to see if one of the participants has mentioned this, but I'm not seeing it. My slide is slightly cut off, so I'll go ahead and take a jab at it. The idea here is, as we said earlier, if the purpose of a remedy, in this case a pump and treat system, is to extract hazardous waste, why would we want to reduce the amount of hazardous waste extracted? So again, there are, as we said, there are 14 different parameters, footprint parameters, that are quantified in a footprint evaluation, and not all of them always relevant to every project. This might be a more relevant parameter, for example, at a dig and haul remedy, where we are extracting contaminated soil, which may be hazardous waste. If we can better define this excavation area and reduce the buffer zone necessary to ensure that we don't leave any waste on site, we will be ensuring the protective remedy while at the same time reducing the hazardous waste from that project, generated from that project. So that's why we've included hazardous waste extracted as one of the parameters, one of the footprint parameters in the methodology.
All right. Moving ahead, I hear that I can buy RECs to offset the carbon footprint of the cleanup. Is that okay? I'll take a stab at that one. It's certainly acceptable to buy RECs to offset the carbon footprint of a cleanup. We like to see that as a step that you would take once you have already optimized your project and reduced your footprint as much as you can. Reduce the footprint as much as it's feasible to do, then buying RECs to offset the remaining carbon footprint is something that is certainly okay to do. Carlos, any additional thoughts on that?
Nope, that's it. Basically, yeah, like you said, the idea is let's first reduce the energy footprint, then apply renewables, and on the balance by REC. So, yep, that's basically the idea.
Okay, very good.
Okay, so I'll take this one here. So the question is that we have up there is using a different reagent in the treatment system will reduce the total CO2 footprint by 5%. However, the footprint analysis margin of error is about 20%. Should I go ahead and try to replace the old reagent with a new one? So this question goes to that what we talked about earlier about the uncertainty of the numbers. If the cost of switching the reagent is nil, then you might go ahead and do that because there's a good probability you're going to get a footprint reduction. The point here, though, is that there's often too much uncertainty to help you, to allow you to make a certain decision here. So in this case, you might want to go back and refine the analysis to see if you can reduce that margin of error. Then again, if depends on the scale of your CO2 footprint, is the 5% reduction significant or not? If it's the largest footprint reduction you can get, and the CO2 footprint is an important part of your total environmental footprint, maybe you want to go ahead and do that. Again, assuming that the cost of switching the reagent is not that significant. This was one of Karen's questions, Hillary, maybe from your past seminar. You want to add something to that?
No, I think you're correct that the main thing here to emphasize is the importance of uncertainty and the margin of error. There are times when it's just not worth it to make a small change if it's well within your margin of error. On the other hand, as you pointed out, if there's no cost or actually a cost savings in changing to a different reagent, then why not do it? So with that, let's go ahead and see what's next. How about if I put up a fence around the site instead of treating the contaminated soil? I'll minimize the environmental footprint and still be protective. Is that what we are trying to achieve? I think the key point here is, what is the selected remedy? We want to select and implement the most appropriate remedy for the site. We're not allowing the environmental footprint to drive the selection here. So unless we're going to fence off the site as our selected remedy, then we would not do that just because that would appear to minimize the environmental footprint and be protective.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point, Hillary. We're not going to change the endpoint to achieve a footprint reduction. The question is, how can we achieve that same endpoint with a lower environmental footprint? So if there was a treatment under consideration, and that is definitely a different endpoint than leaving waste on site, applying ICs, et cetera. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the questions here. We have one question from Brian Betts. On slide 70, can you clarify whether short-term aggressive remediation programs typically have a larger footprint than longer-term, slower programs, and therefore the short-term approaches have a greater opportunity for footprint reductions? So I think the answer is yes, but we're not talking about programs. We're talking about remedies. What remedial approaches are we taking? And definitely shorter-term aggressive ones tend to have a larger environmental footprint, and there probably are greater environmental footprint reduction opportunities associated with those, and those are many of which we would conduct a footprint analysis to better understand the operating parameters of that remedy and focus on footprint reduction efforts. So I hope that answers your question, Brian. I'll be monitoring the screen in case it doesn't. Hillary?
Carlos, also Angela Fisher asked, did someone submit that question? And I'm not sure exactly what question, but all these questions that we're reading, these discussion questions, are ones that our group of instructors generated, ones that we thought might get to some of the points that we're trying to do. So none of the questions that you're seeing that are actually part of the PowerPoint presentation itself are submitted from today's audience.
Yeah, that's correct. We did have, for example, that first webinar we had a year ago, and then a lot of our internal training for our people. These are recurring questions that seem to pop up quite often, and this is an opportunity to get some of those answers out there. You're welcome, Angela.
We have a few more of these to go through, and then we have some time to open the floor. So next one up, the project contractor used the EPA footprint evaluation methodology. Of course, that would mean that their footprint is correctly done, right?
Yes, surprisingly, we do get that question quite often. And the fact that the footprint methodology has been applied doesn't mean that the footprint itself is correct. I often use the analogy of just because you use the IRS online tax 1040 doesn't mean your return is correct. It depends on the data you enter and the assumptions you make. So while it will facilitate communication, discussions, et cetera, certainly with EPA, the fact that it was run with, that the footprint was conducted using the footprint methodology and the CEFA spreadsheets certainly does not mean it was done correctly.
How about phytoremediation has a lower footprint than in-situ thermal remediation? Does that mean it is greener?
Yeah, and this is a classic, and we unfortunately still see that at a lot of conferences such as Battelle, et cetera. We often hear people qualifying any one technology as a greener technology, and it is our perspective that any technology can be built and operated in a greener way. And phytoremediation is a classic example. Use the analogy of two phytoremediation projects, one where we use a native species, we use low-till, no herbicides, no pesticides, no fertilizers, et cetera. Whereas next door we have another one where we use fertilizer generously, impacting surface water bodies, et cetera. The point is that we can have one phytoremediation project that's green and one that is not, yet they are both phytoremediation. Let's look at one remedy versus itself, not versus something else. And it goes back to that changing the endpoint we talked about earlier. It's kind of like related to that.
All right, we have two more questions to do. My footprint evaluation is complete, and greenhouse gas has the largest number. Should I prioritize efforts to reduce greenhouse gas before other elements? Well, in general, I think that we do want to focus on the aspects of the footprint that are the largest contributors and the contributors where we think we can make the greatest change.
Yeah, and maybe another point is, remember that slide where we had some of the considerations? There may be other footprint elements, such as SOx, NOx, that are relatively quantitatively smaller but are having a significant impact. If you are in an urban area, the project is taking place in midsummer where we have high tropospheric ozone potential and we're emitting a lot of nitrogen oxides. Well, maybe we want to focus on reducing those nitrogen oxides. So it's very project specific. But definitely, if the purpose of the methodology is to provide you with those relative numbers so you can make that decision. If greenhouse gas is a very significant, you see an opportunity to reduce it, go for it.
Okay. I'm in the design phase of a remediation project. Should I go straight to proposing footprint reduction, or do I need a quantitative evaluation?
So the idea here is that it's possible if you have a very standard project that you can go straight to the, you know, apply the BMPs. For example, if you have a bioremediation project, look at the BMPs. But if you have a large complex site, which is atypical, a footprint evaluation for relatively small additional cost will provide you with that quantified footprint and with the breakdown of the operating systems and what the footprint contributors are, so you can better define how you can design that system to achieve those footprint reductions. Okay, Hillary, I'm seeing a couple of questions here. Let me take the first one is from Deep Tinair. Typically, what does hazardous air pollutant consist of? It's very project specific. You know, it could be, for example, volatile organic carbons. It could be either fugitive emissions from the remedy or from some of the operating parameters. So again, it's very system specific, and that's one of the purposes of conducting the footprint evaluation, so we can see what system parameters might be generating those hazardous air pollutants.
Okay, there's a question from James Teo, is EPA implementing footprint analysis as a standard practice to all EPA projects? I would say that we are not implementing it as standard practice to all EPA projects, but we are asking that it be considered at projects in our cleanup programs where appropriate. And through the course of our training process here, we're hoping to educate folks so that they can understand what we mean by where appropriate.
Okay. And, yeah, I got a reminder that we did receive a question by email before the webinar. I pulled up the email. Let me go ahead and read the question, and then we can discuss it. So it's company operating a pump and tree system to address chlorinated solvents in the deep bedrock aquifer that under the current strategy will basically be operating forever. And yes, we've heard of those. So while the system is on track to restore the downgrading aquifer after many decades of operation, currently that will only be achieved by continuous pumping. They do not believe that is either sustainable or green. And they believe that there's a possibility to enhance bio or some other source reduction technology to reduce the mass flux concentrations in the plume. However, there's no practical option to restore the aquifer to drinking water levels. drinking water pathway has been addressed via city ordinance prohibiting well installations, da-da-da-da-da. So I guess we kind of like addressed this, and maybe we should have been a little bit more specific. Earlier on when we talked about remedial strategies, I mentioned that basic concept, yes, that we may be using more aggressive remedies in the source area that may achieve, for example, a 98% mass reduction, but that 2% residual mass of chlorinated solvents will still keep that, contaminate that plume through could still contaminate that plume, I'm trying to say. So what have we achieved there? What we might have achieved is a significant reduction in the plume size, where we can greatly downsize the pump and treat component of it to an area much more in the vicinity of that source area, which we haven't been able to zap completely, and let M&A take over in the perimeter. So possibly we will still take a couple of decades, but we'll take a couple of decades to reach that cleanup level with a much smaller active remedy, thanks to that source removal. And the source removal is one where we would likely have applied the footprint evaluation. So I hope that answers the question.
I think it does, Carlos. And I'd like to follow up with another one from James Teo. Also, has the use of footprint analysis been implemented within the feasibility study process and criteria? I think that hits on some key hot button issues there.
We mentioned that briefly. Not sure if you happen to have the material from our discussion in Region 9, or maybe Julie can step in there. But as we mentioned opening up, there currently is within the 9 criteria on short-term effectiveness, there is an opportunity to look at short-term remedy effectiveness, and which includes parameters such as basically what would be negative externalities. However, the point here is if you are doing a footprint analysis in your IFS, we may also want to look at what did you do about that footprint. So don't take it as is. If that remedy were to be selected, how could that footprint be reduced, and then factor that residual footprint into the decision process. But again, as we mentioned earlier, we have not seen a situation where an environmental footprint is a remedy decision driver. Okay, well, I'm looking at the screen. I'm not sure I'm seeing another question. Our colleague Julie did mention some of the tools out there.
There was a question that came earlier from another participant that wanted to get into the applicability of this approach. And Specifically, I think you guys had talked about the types of sites, but the question specifically asks, is this analysis recommended for all sizes of projects or just primarily large-scale projects? So perhaps you could comment on that.
I would say, and again, this is from what we have seen so far, certainly for large, complex projects, it's more applicable than at a small, brownfield site where we're excavating, 100 cubic yards. However, if one does conduct many of those projects, it might be good to run a footprint analysis, because that will give you a better baseline and a better feel for what footprint reduction you are achieving and how to perfect your approaches. So if your focus is doing digging holes, conduct the footprint, see what those remedy components are, contributors are, and refine your approach doing that. If you're doing a one-time small project, it's probably not worth your time, no. You can just take a fact sheet and run off of that.
And to the remedy selection and the use of the footprint analysis, we just wanted to emphasize that this is not a driver of the remedy selection. That is not the purpose of conducting the footprint analysis.
Yes, thank you, Julie. Correct. So I was saying that there are some tools out there. You might have heard of SiteWise. Was produced by Battelle. I believe it's the Navy and I'm not sure who the other entity is right now, but the Air Force produced the sustainable remediation tool early on. You know, we have expressed some concerns about the fact that they sometimes seem to be used, designed to select the greener remedy rather than identifying footprint reduction opportunities. But there are ongoing discussions with the services. We have a memorandum of understanding with the Air Force at Region 9, Julie's region, is working on to collaborate on conducting footprint evaluations at large remedies and understanding where the discrepancies or differences are in the footprint results and working jointly to identify what the footprint reductions opportunities are. So we definitely are continuing to work with these different entities, and there's a new one, a proposal that's been submitted for CERTIP ESTCP to further that work. So we do hope to achieve a certain level of convergence as we go forward with those. Okay, I see another spread question that came in from Bernetta Simon. Where can we find the Excel workbooks? Good question. I should have forwarded to the next slide. Here we go. So on the second slide, the second entry you see there, Kluwen Green Remediation Focus Area, it's a section of the Kluwen website. Thanks, Hillary. Pointed with the little green arrow. And on that site, on the right hand, when you go to kluwen.org/green remediation, you will see a section on the upper right hand side that talks about footprint methodology. You go there and you can download the methodology and the spreadsheets, and that's where some of the tutorial is. This webinar will be linked directly there, as well as past webinars. Future webinars will also link to them from there. If you visit the Kluwen website, if you have not already subscribed to Tech Direct, that is a monthly listserv we put out there. And I think Gene's also going to talk about some of these a little bit later. Some of the more current technologies, listservs are passe. But anyway, there are many, many means of staying current on future webinars, including the one we mentioned that goes into more detail about how to enter and run the CIFA spreadsheets. But anyway, thanks for the question, Vernetta. Kluwen.org/green remediation. That is where the spreadsheets can be downloaded, as well as the tutorial and the methodology.
All right. There's a whole lot of other information and resources on slide 80 here as well. In addition, there's on the next slide, we have EPA regional points of contact in each of the 10 EPA regions, both the Superfund Green Remediation regional coordinators on the left side, and on the right-hand side, your engineering forum, environmental footprint methodology, points of contact. So if you're a person with an EPA affiliation and you're in one of these regions, feel free to contact your regional contact and they'll help you get started. Let's see, we have any other slides? I think these last couple are for Gene to share the ways to stay connected and all. There are a couple more questions that have come in that we could address, I think.
Yes, Hillary, please go right ahead and keep going. You guys still have some time.
Sure. James Hunt said, my comment was, is there a way to reopen a final decision when there might be huge green benefits, but we might need to alter the endpoint somewhat? So, Carlos, you want to take a stab at that one?
Well, I'm not too sure what the situation is, but certainly in the optimization analyses that we are conducting, particularly pump and treat optimizations, we've already conducted about 160 at the fund lead pump and treat systems, and we certainly are, a lot of the recommendations have to do with remedy operation, and we are revisiting those remedies. So that certainly is a potential. It usually is going to require a significant investment of resources up front, especially on that that source area removal to right-size the system and possibly achieve those goals earlier. I would suggest that you go to the Kluin optimization section. So it's basically kluin.org/optimization. And we've got a lot of the reports on our remedy optimization evaluations up there. And you should find some examples of situations where what was recommended was to change a remedy, maybe in the way that we discussed earlier. So that is happening, yes.
Okay, we have another question. How does this analysis correlate with NEPA effects analysis? Is this primarily from a CERCLA perspective and therefore replaces the NEPA analysis?
So I'm not that familiar with NEPA. Certainly the driver for NEPA is different. But it's possible that some of the footprint It's different. What we have looked at is in developing the footprint methodology, we did look at, for example, whether there were other similar methodologies to evaluate environmental footprints from the construction sector and others, and we did borrow some of the information from there. So from that point of view, if there's a lack of such an analysis or if a remedy is part of a NEPA analysis, footprint data from a footprint analysis might be of value in that process, basically because we're looking at the environmental footprint of achieving remedy protectiveness. However, NEPA is a different regulatory framework, so it would not be a driver for footprint analysis.
Now, part of the question is, is this primarily from a CERCLA perspective? Well, we've tried to write this to be cross-program and include things like RCRA, brownfields, UST, emergency removal, things like that.
Right, correct. Okay. And exactly. So it certainly does not replace the NEPA analysis. If anything, it might help, might provide some information for a NEPA analysis, but it certainly does not replace it. And it certainly is not unique to CERCLA. It's cross-program. In fact, as I said, it could be used for any construction project. Okay, I think, Jean, I'm not seeing more questions here. I hope
I've got one more that came in earlier, just in general about updates or suggested revisions to the spreadsheet. Are you accepting them, or are you revising these spreadsheets on a regular schedule?
Yes, good point. Thanks for bringing that up, Jean. So we have been receiving some, you know, as users have been downloading and using the spreadsheets, they identified a few bugs that we've been able to work out. As I mentioned, we're not in the software development business, so there's zero user support. This is making spreadsheets that we develop for internal use available to others, but we think they're all working quite well. And if people have recommendations for improvement, we probably will be looking at, we compile those, and then we will periodically go back and run a cleaning up, or if you will, of the fact sheet. So yes, please, an improvement, do send it to us. We'd love to take it into consideration.
Hi, Carlos, this is Julie. There's also a question regarding training. It's coming from Olivia Kenzie. It says, earlier in the presentation, stated footprint evaluations are not required for cleanups. What criteria are being used to determine the sites which will undergo this analysis, and how this ambition to change based on ongoing EPA training efforts?
So criteria are really driven. It's driven by the project manager, the EPA project manager, RPM, where a lot of the training and the application of the footprint methodology described earlier is focusing on sites where the Superfund is the lead agency in conducting the cleanup at fund lead sites. That's where we are focusing our efforts right now. We're also working with other project managers that, for example, oversee the federal facilities or responsible party cleanups. so that they're better prepared to, or we can support them if a footprint analysis is conducted at those projects. But our main focus right now is to support remedial project managers who determine that, you know, as we said earlier, that the projects are large and complex enough that they merit footprint evaluation. But it is a project manager's decision whether or not to conduct the footprint evaluation.
I also may want to add that to point everybody again to the slide that is in the screen, this is EPA regional points of contact. If you are a PRP or a PRP contractor or a contractor for EPA, you can contact your regional RPM, your site RPM, and they can contact us. We are trying to train as many contractors, EPA contractors, as we can. Right now, Region 9 has conducted a couple of them already. We are available. Karen Sherman is working with us in providing training for CIFA, and when the methodology is available on the internet, but if you want some more specific training, we can help you, especially if you work as an RPM, I mean as a contractor for Region 9.
Okay, great. Any other closing statements or thoughts from either Carlos or Hilary?
No, thanks. Thank you all for your interest, and we do hope to cross paths again. If you have questions about the methodology or its application, do feel free to contact me, or as Julie said, any of the points of contact on the screen now to keep those handy. As you know, at epa.gov, there's a people locator that works very well. You just enter the first name, last name, and you will get that person's email address and phone number. So while they're not on the screen, just capture the screen and keep it handy. You can find us all on the EPA locator.
And we're looking to put examples of where the methodology has been used onto the website to assist others and show them examples. And we could certainly always use that information in future versions of this presentation to keep it fresh and relevant. People like to see real-world examples of where the methodology has been applied. So if you have anything like that you're willing to share with us, get it to myself or to Carlos. We appreciate it. Thank you for your attention today.
Yes, we'd be glad to highlight those projects. One last thing I should have mentioned earlier, it slipped my mind. The ASTM Standard Guide for Greener Cleanups, many of you may know that has been under development for about 3 years now. And the ASTM expects to release the standard guide sometime this summer. The standard guide basically looks at the concept of what we're talking about today, looking at how cleanups can be achieved with a lower environmental footprint. It provides a protocol for doing that, you know, a process for documenting decisions that have been made, et cetera. There's some legal, all kinds of people participated in that state. But anyway, we do expect that the ASTM Standard Guide for Greening Cleanups will be released sometime this summer, and it does point to environmental footprint evaluation as one of the options when applicable. And this would certainly fit under one of the approaches that could be taken to conduct that environmental footprint. So be on the lookout for that. You want to Google it, ASTM, Standard Guide for Greener Cleanups. And we're working with them, with ASTM, possibly on hosting a webinar on the standard guide when it becomes available later this summer. So again, that might be a little bit more of incentive or slash driver to conduct footprint evaluations. Thanks for the reminder there. And that's it for me. Thanks, guys.
Okay, great. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and walk through some of our closeout procedures for today's seminar. I want to thank the nearly 150 individuals who actually were on the line live for today's broadcast. If you're interested in learning more about what we do at the Cleanup Information Network, I'd encourage you to visit the CLUIN website at cluin.org. You can also find us and connect with us in popular professional and social networking sites such as Facebook, Twitter, and even LinkedIn. We do monitor those pages and always encourage people to submit questions and ideas and share information with us. For those of you that joined us for today's live broadcast, we have collected a number of resources and references in addition to the PowerPoint presentation materials available for you to access and download. You'll find that on something we call the resources or links page. It's actively hyperlinked on the right window under seminar resources. If you click that and open it up, you'll be able to download the slides and take a look at a few other related websites. The other link I want to draw your attention to is the seminar feedback form. We would ask if you could take just a moment to fill out that short form to comment on both our physical delivery mechanism for today's seminar as well as the topics and content that were presented today. If you shared the line with multiple people, once you fill out the form, another person will see a link and they can actually click on it and fill out their own feedback form from the same computer. Again, if you're not able to do it right now, that feedback form is active and will be available from this point forward. So if you're listening to the recorded version of today's seminar, you too can still submit feedback based on replaying the archived session. If you're looking for confirmation or verification of your attendance in today's seminar, we don't necessarily issue CEUs or PDHs through Cluin, but many of our participants are still able to earn credit for attending our event. If you keep a copy of your registration email, have a copy of the presentation materials, and then fill out the feedback form, there's a box you can check that appears on that feedback form page to request a confirmation email to be sent to you, which will at least verify that you submitted feedback after the live delivery. Oftentimes when you take all of those materials and submit them to your training coordinator or your accrediting institution, you can still get credit for attending in our seminars. Again, we did record today's seminar, and as soon as that archive is available, you will automatically receive an email pointing you to the location of where you can replay that, and you're certainly welcome to forward it on to anyone that you think would find it useful. I want to thank all of the presenters who were able to join us from a number of locations here at EPA, as well as my co-host, Carlos Pachon, from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Thank you so very much for joining us today. This represents the